Today we're breaking down Weapons, a film the director claims was inspired by alcoholism, but trust me, they packed this thing with so much occult symbolism, it might as well be a ritual. A missing classroom of kids in Maybrook, PA, where the mascot is a goat. A mass sleepwalking event that goes down at 2:17 a.m. on 8-8. The Sirius Lion Gates portal, parasitic mind control, numerology tying into Osiris, Q, and Crowley's Lieber 7-7, plus a witch aunt literally weaponizing children through magic. This movie hints at the subconscious, the basement, the hidden sun, and maybe the end times of the new aeon. My supporters got to vote on which film analysis they wanted for their bonus show for the month of October, and this controversial new film called Weapons was the winner, so I'm here to deliver, and I'll be honest, I'm a bit surprised at how much I was able to find here. Join along as we decode Weapons. We're going to walk through this whole film, starting with a brief discussion of the cast and all that stuff I do, the preamble for the movie. Then we're going to hit the ground running. We've got some hidden messaging, goats with the bobs. We got 1948, what that means, the Sirius Lion Gates portal of the blazing star of Freemasonry, 217 and the meaning of that, connections to Stephen King, The Shining, QAnon, Osiris and the resurrection ritual, Mark of the Beast, parasitic mushrooms, seven glizzies, and the meaning of that bell with the triangle, with the number six, the tree, MK Ultra, Campbell's soup, Coca-Cola. We'll pull it all together. In the conclusion, I'll pitch my theory about the coded meaning of this film as the summoning of the Antichrist through Aleister Crowley's Whore of Babylon. Now, that's a lot, because there's a lot to get through. So we're going to try to buzz through this thing. And if you're free feed losing, you're going to get a preview. And you're going to say, dang, Isaac, I want to buy you a coffee so hard right now to unlock the whole show, along with the hundreds of other bonus shows you do every single month for the supporters and go ad-free with early access and the whole works. Well, you got three options for supporter feeds. The one I recommend is patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher. The easiest one is Apple Premium. The cheapest one, if you can copy and paste an RSS feed link and deal with me as your tech support guru, IlluminatiWatcher.com, the VIP section. Everything is always linked in the bio. See if this is your month to buy me a cup of coffee. With inflation, it's now cheaper than a cup of coffee. Oh, my goodness. And thank you for all my supporters that have been supporting the show, keeping it alive. Appreciate you, as always. Now, I'll put a bunch of episodes in the show notes that you can link to. You can check out if you want to dig deeper into some of these topics that I'm going to bring up throughout the analysis. For maybe the newbies that don't understand some of these concepts and it's too confusing, because we don't have time to unpack the gory details of each of these kind of complex theories. So I'm going to refer you to the episodes that I'll link in the show notes. Okay. Also, another reminder for my people that are on Patreon or VIP section. If you're looking for the video version of this, that's a tier two perk, right? I know it's goofy, right? But anyway, this is how it was set up years ago back in 2017 when I started this. So tier two is the video version of the show where you can watch the movie clips and all the images I'm talking about as I bring them up. That's going to be on tier two. And when you're on tier two, there's going to be a link in every episode show notes for the tier two video index. Okay. All right. Now, the preambles I do for the movie reviews, because I find these important. How long is this movie? Well, it's over 2 hours, just barely, which honestly kind of surprised me for how speedy this thing moved through the story. So it's 2 hours, but little asterisk, it moves pretty quick. And in fact, the next question you're going to ask is, well, should I watch it before I listen? It's one of the better horror movies I've seen in a while. It's a great little horror mystery. But there's a few very gory scenes, so if you're a little sensitive, maybe you're not going to love these couple of scenes where it gets pretty gory. In fact, when I watched the trailer for this movie, I thought it looked stupid. I wasn't going to watch it. But due to high demand and, of course, the supporter feeds who voted on what movie analysis they wanted for their bonus show for October, Weapons was the winner. So here you go. And like I said earlier, I actually watched this movie. And I thought, okay, I mean, there's some witchcraft in there. I can figure out something to talk about with this guy. And then it won the poll that I did. And I rewatched it and I thought, there's a ton of stuff in here. So I'm glad this worked out very well. because we'll go through it. Okay, there's a ton of stuff in here. And if you do plan on watching this, I highly recommend watching it before listening to this analysis, because it's the mystery of the movie that keeps you locked in for those 2 hours, okay? Now, the next segment, of course, who's in it? You got the cast and the crew. Directed and written by Zach Cregger, who also wrote and directed Barbarian, which was also a great movie. Fun fact, he's married to Sarah Paxton. She was in Twin Peaks: The Return. She played Candy Shaker, and she is, which I'm just now realizing, quite the curious name, because she plays this sort of eye candy character. So kind of a funny play on words for her name in Twin Peaks. Also, side plug, I just got back from Seattle, and where I got to meet Ray Wise and Cheryl Lee and Mary Reber and David Lynch's sister. It was insane. It was incredible. And if you want to learn more about that, I've got a special edition Grey Lodge episode over on Breaking Social Norms, because I took my lovely wife, Josie, and we unpack the trip to Seattle, what it's like, what we talked to them, some crazy questions I asked. You can hear what Cheryl Lee thought of my tattoo of her and how she shot me down. You'll have to listen for more of the exciting details on Breaking Social Norms. Okay. Now, in the movie, so Sarah Paxton is also in Weapons. She plays the wife of Justin Long's character. He was in a movie called Idiocracy, which we prophetically covered in March of 2023, because we keep marching down this stupid path. Again, I'll link that Idiocracy in the show notes. It was a great time doing that analysis, because that was one of my favorite movies back when I watched it in 2005 or whatever it was. Now, the producer of Weapons was a guy named Roy Lee, and I never heard about this guy, but he's produced just about every movie in history. If you don't believe me, look him up on Wikipedia. I won't even try to go through the list. It's insane. Josh Brolin, old big head there, plays Archer. I've heard something about how Hollywood likes actors with big heads, and my man's got a big head. All right, big head for some big brains. And he was in The Goonies, right? Which I will do a film analysis on sometime here for my number one supporter, Cheryl. It's in the works. Give me 12 months. I know I work on a slow, but you know, I can't rush art. Okay. When the stars align, I will make that happen. He was also in No Country for Old Men, which I criminally have not even seen yet. It's on my list. I got to watch it. I know it's great. He also plays Thanos in The Avengers, and he's in Dune. What more could you ask for? Well, you could ask for an 80s movie called Thrashing, where he's a skateboarder that stars Sherilyn Fenn, our beloved Audrey Horne, who still has me blocked on Instagram. And I did watch Thrashing a while ago. Great 80s movie. You can't stop Josh Brolin, is what I'm trying to get at here. Even when it comes to wives, he's been married and divorced 3 times, including Diane Lane. He's a Nepo baby. His dad was an actor. His dad was in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And at the end of the movie in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you see a film being made about the life of Pee-wee Herman. And guess who plays Pee-wee Herman? My man, Josh Brolin's dad. So... And his mom, and Josh Brolin's mom was a casting director. His stepmom is Barbara Streisand. Of course he's going to be a famous celebrity, right? Now he says, he tells his life history that he grew up in the rough side of town, which I thought, really? That's kind of strange. He said he was rolling with a bunch of punk rockers and they were stealing cars to support his heroin addiction. So, hey, I'm not judging. Now, Archer was originally going to be played by Pedro Pascal, but he had committed to Fantastic Four, which I met my man down in Salt Lake, was going to see Fantastic Four. I'm waiting for him to hit me up and tell me how it was. I met him at the Italian Fest. Anyway, Pedro Pascal was going to be Archer, but they tapped Big Head to get in there and do it. Julia Garner, she plays Justine Gandy. And she was in the Netflix show Ozark with Jason Bateman. The first couple seasons were great. I stopped watching it for no reason at all. And she's most famous for that meme of if you want to stop me, you're going to have to kill me. You know what I'm talking about. Or if you don't, maybe I'm more chronically online than some of you. She was in a show called The Americans. I've never seen it. She was in Apartment 7A, which was the prequel to Rosemary's Baby, which I surprisingly liked. I thought that was fair. Everyone hated it. They proceeded to shat on it. I don't know why. I thought it was good enough. She was in Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, the sequel, and that also starred Josh Brolin. Alden Ehrenreich, I don't know if I'm saying his name right, he plays the police officer Paul. He got his start after meeting Spielberg at a bar mitzvah and later worked on Francis Ford Coppola's Tidor after auditioning by reading Catcher in the Rye, which we did a two-part series on in February of 2025. Again, I'll link in the show notes. Unless you're on the VIP section, I can't link. You're just going to have to like scroll back in time to that correct episode. Patreon, I'll try to dig up the links for you guys to keep it easy. Apple Premium, obviously, I can't link those. You're going to see links in the free feed, but that's for the free feed ad-filled versions of those episodes. So my recommendation, if you're on the supporter feed, scroll back. Avoid the ads. Benedict Wong plays Marcus. He's the principal. He was in Sunshine, which we just did a film analysis for as the bonus episode in August, I believe. And he was also in The Avengers with Josh Brolin. Amy Madigan, she plays Aunt Gladys. She was in Uncle Buck, Field of Dreams, Gone Baby Gone. She was in Carnival, which I want to rewatch. I watched that back in the day when it came out. Stars the man from Another Place from Twin Peaks. Now, I didn't know this, but she's been married to Ed Harris since 1983, and he's always in good stuff. He was in Truman Show. He played Kristoff, which we covered Truman Show back in January 2020. Even the soundtrack is full of stars. The movie features prominently one of George Harrison's biggest songs called Beware of Darkness, which featured apparently Eric Clapton, Ringo Starr, Gary Wright, and of course, George Harrison. But it's a song about not getting bogged down in the illusory nature of reality, what they call Maya. The Toltecs call it Maya. And it's about finding one's own true will and purpose, which is very apropos for the Aleister Crowley aspect that we're going to tie into, since he was the guy who basically came up with this idea of pursuing one's true will. All right? It's about pursuing your universal purpose. Now, we're going to get into the movie. Plot spoilers coming. I'm going to walk you through the whole thing. So even if you're scared a little bit, I'll walk you through. You don't need to be scared. You don't need to see the gore. I'll walk you through. And it's the perfect time. It's spooky season, of course. So without further ado, let's get into it. We start with a young female narrator, and she sounds like the girl on, if you've heard the great album Liquid Swords by GZA from the Wu-Tang Clan. Anyway, she sounds like her, but she claims this is a true story. I'm like, oh, here we go with the true story thing. We just talked about this with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Anyway, she says a true story happened 2 years ago. The news won't cover it because the government police couldn't solve it. And, you know, they can never admit to incompetency. And it talks about this elementary school in Maybrook, PA. It was actually filmed in Georgia because there is no Maybrook, PA. But listen to this girl. She's going to basically explain the whole mystery of this film. So take a listen.
This is a true story. It happened right here in my town 2 years ago. A lot of people die in a lot of really weird ways in this story, but you're not going to find it in the news or anywhere like that, because the police and the top people in this town were like so embarrassed that they weren't able to solve it that they covered everything all up. But if you come here and ask anyone, they'll all tell you the same thing that I'm going to tell you now. This story starts in my school. Maybrook Elementary is kindergarten through fifth grade. So this one Wednesday is like a normal day for the whole school. And they had this teacher who was new. Her name was Justine Gandy. And on this day, she was going to her classroom just like every morning. But today was different. Today, none of her kids were there. Every other class at that school had all their kids. Even the other third grade Mrs. Belt taught was full. But Mrs. Gandy's room was totally empty. Well, not totally. There was one boy there, and his name was Alex Lilly. And he was the only kid in the class of 18 that came to school that day. And do you know why? He was the only one there. Because the night before, at 2:17 in the morning, every other kid woke up, got out of bed, walked downstairs, opened the front door, walked across the front yard and into the dark, and they never came back.
Now, right off the rip, we're going to see some images, and you got to look, you got to frame by frame it. The Maybrook mascot is a goat, right? I don't see no Bobs, but the Bobs are there. We just don't see it on the logo for the school. But the mascot's a goat. You see it on the logo. You see some posters. Now, in the opening shot, if you're not watching the video version of this podcast, the opening shot, you see the teacher, Justine Grady, walking down the hallway, and you'll see a lot of posters on the wall, and it's like class president, running for class president posters, you know, whatever, right? Silly stuff. One poster out of all those doesn't have any text on it at all. Clearly begging for our attention, but you wouldn't notice it. In fact, I didn't see it the first two times I watched this movie. And to me, what it looks like, and it's hard to tell. I try to run it in HD on my big screen, and it wasn't any better. But you can see the images I'll put on the Instagram at Isaac Weishaupt. Like and subscribe. Or I'll put on the video version for my video folks. What you're going to see is what appears to be, a magician on the peak of a mountain with a goat climbing the mountain. And you're going to see 17 kids, each in a little pond, a little like body of water. I counted it up, 17 exactly. And this is very important. It's very important because that's what the story is. It's about at 2:17 a.m., 17 students disappear. So it's very important. And I liken this to the initiation ritual of Jodorowsky's film, The Holy Mountain. In fact, the colors on it, for some reason, strike me as similar to The Holy Mountain for no reason at all. It's like the blue and the yellow. But nonetheless, that tells you this film is loaded down with symbolism that they baked into the background. In fact, I'm going to tell you right now, I bet I could watch this again a fourth time and probably find even more. All right. Now, the new teacher, her name is Justine Gandy, and she goes to class. There's only one student named Alex Lilly. That's our protagonist. That's our hero's journey guy. All right. And in the background of the classroom, the first time I watched this, there's a whale. There's a board of whales with some weird words that look like magical incantations to me. Okay. And I'm going to prove to you why you should trust me, because I looked them up, and it turns out I'm very wrong about that. The words are Odonseti and Mysticeti. And turns out those are actually species of whales. I mean, my PA public education failed me, apparently. So, not magical incantations at all. I thought they were, like Odonteses. I don't even know how to say, I'm so stupid, I don't know how to say the words. Odontocetes, they are the whales that have teeth, and Mysticetes, they use the, what they call baleen. They filter out food through these big mouths full of water. I don't know. There's this thing with sea creatures in this movie that I can't quite unpack yet. There's sharks and whales and all kinds of stuff. Now, you also see in the classroom, very briefly, again, you got to freeze it frame by frame, there's a poster board about killings in India in 1948. I looked this up. It's got to be referencing the assassination of Gandhi, all right? Because that's when that happened. Funny enough, the teacher's last name is Gandhi. Got to be on purpose. Later on, we'll also see One of the house numbers is 1948. Why all the references to 1948? Well, there's one particular place that was formally established and given statehood as its own country, and it's been very controversial ever since. It's about the size of New Jersey. The colors are blue and white. Is this film referencing that? I believe it is. I have some ideas that we're going to talk about in the conclusion, but it's relevant. Somehow, I'll explain it to you. Now, it's 2:17 in the morning, and those 17 students, they all wake up, they walk out their home, they never come back. They do that little Naruto run where their arms are flailing back. The director claims that this was influenced by that horrendous Vietnam War photo of the girl who got napalmed running. Ugh. Brutal, right? Now, fun fact. The first theater run of this movie started the movie at 2:17 p.m. Furthermore, it was released on August 8th, which is the peak of the Lionsgate portal for Sirius. And this is quite important in terms of astrology because it's the peak of Sirius's power as it comes into alignment with Orion and Earth. And the sun activates the power of Sirius. We get the dog days of summer, you know, which is a reference to the dog star, Sirius. And it's a time of manifestation for magicians, which is very important because that's what this thing is all about, all right? And I talked heavily about Sirius and the importance of that star system to the occult in my book, The Dark Path. If you haven't heard that, I narrated it for Audible. It's my bestseller. I've unloaded a ton of copies on Amazon. I got signed copies at my new web store, occultsymbolism.com, where you can also pick up my mushroom-infused coffee. Oh, my goodness. You want to hit that CrossFit wad? You want that high tea? I don't know. It's very good coffee, though. Mushroom-infused coffee at occultsymbolism.com and The Dark Path. But the reason that Sirius is important, to give you a very short version of it, is because these occultists believe in cosmic energy, which comes through Sirius, which is why you see in Freemasonry, they have the symbol of the blazing star, which is actually a reference to Sirius. And this goes back to the Babylonians and Aleister Crowley and Kenneth Grant. They call this the hidden sun, the sun behind the sun, right? They say it's the source of the occult powers, the thalamic current of magic. And again, the eschatology of Crowley will play into my theory on what is happening in this film, all right? Now, 2:17 is also important. 2:17 a.m. is when they got up out of bed, right? 2:17, also part of the story of The Shining and Dr. Sleep, the sequel to The Shining, which is about alcoholism with Jack Torrance and Danny Torrance, which is a major part of this film. And the director confirmed it as his experience. We're going to talk about that later on in the conclusion. But as far as The Shining connection, recall I did a 3-part Shining analysis just recently. And it's also entirely up on, I made a 1 long video on YouTube. It's like 3.5 hours. Okay. So subscribe on YouTube at Occult Symbolism. I can upload some of my video analysis there. Some of them, they block. They blocked the video clips from it. But anyway, I talked about how in the analysis, to try to keep this simple, I'm not going to make you go listen to the full 3.5 hours unless you want all the gory details. We talked about how Stephen King's novel has Danny finding the woman in room 217. And I talked about how this is a reference to the story of Bluebeard and the hidden chamber. And in Stephen King's book, Jack actually finds George Hatfield in the bathtub in 217. All right. Because in the movie version, you see the woman in the bathtub of 237, because, you know, Cooper changes to 237. And all that's important because it ties into Kabbalah with the mikveh, the cleansing ritual bath, and all that stuff. Now, to stick to weapons and 217, there's a lot of theories about what that could symbolize. Some people say it's the two parents and the 17 children who all get under the spell of the witch. But there's a spiritual meaning of 217 as well, which we'll have to unpack at the end. And there's a lot of numerology in the film, all right? Like I said, it's got symbolism for sure. No denying it. So we have to now look at all the other aspects of it. Because normally, I don't get into too deep in the gematria numerology, but as you'll find out when we go through the film, there's Kabbalistic ideas going on. All right. And the 17th letter in the alphabet is Q. And back in 2020, we did a QAnon symbolism show. I think it was like a three-parter. And you're probably going to know where we went with this, because we talked about how Osiris was killed on the 17th day of March, as per Plutarch. Now, March 17th is the 77th day of the year. And that ties into 77, which is one of Crowley's favorite numbers because of Libra 77. And you also see it on the sigil for the Star of Babylon that he created. And maybe you're picking up what I'm putting down. I'll explain it at the end in case you're not. It's not time yet, right? Let's keep going, though. What, you know, it's. I know I sound like a lunatic. If you're like, if you're not familiar with these things, you're probably like, bro, what are you rambling on about? Then we get the title screen for the movie. It says weapons. It has a, for the O in weapons, it has a circle. And inside the circle is a triangle. Oh, what could it mean? Oh, my goodness. Well, you probably know where we're going because it has to do with magic. All right. And the symbol is used in AA, which we're going to actually talk about, like I said earlier, just a little bit later. It's not a huge component of the theory, but it's there. And in occultism, we know that the triangle fused with the circle, it shows us the microcosm and the macrocosm together. It's the as above, so below symbol, all right? And, you know, of course it is. After you finish the movie, you're like, of course that makes sense now. So the police interrogate Alex Lilly. He's, like I said, he's the one boy left that hasn't disappeared. And he's like, dude, I don't know what's going on, all right? And you'll notice at the police station, they've got checkered floors. And this is a reference to the opposing polarities. All right. This is the goat with the bobs. Maybook PA is the goat logo as its mascot. And you're going to find multiple examples of checkered floors, which you find, of course, in the Freemason lodges, the Moses pavement. All right. It represents the knowledge of good and evil, the opposing forces. So this town of Maybrook has this little PTA meeting before they open up the school again. They were closed because of the, you know, the mystery of these disappearing kids. All right. So they're at this PTA meeting and we're watching Justine's story, the teacher, Justine Gandhi. And at this PTA, the parents, they're getting pissed off at her. They think she knows what's going on because it was her class. The principal has to escort her to the car because they're so mad. And she heads to the liquor store. She's going to get loaded, right? She gets some vodka. She takes some threatening phone calls. She gets home. Of course, she's kind of paranoid. She's freaking out. She's watching Shark Tank, which I actually love Shark Tank. I haven't seen that in a while. I need to watch it. And the shark symbolism is what we also see with Alex at the beginning of the movie. He's wearing a shirt, I believe, or a backpack with a shark on it. But the, you know, and like I said, I don't have anything good for how that connects in, you know, maybe chime in the comments if you figured it out. I don't know. So someone knocks on Justine's door and they're trying to spook her, right? And she looks outside. Her car has the word witch painted on it. And I believe this is literally witchcraft, literal, you know, witch and magic stuff. And the next day, Justine, she goes back to school. She goes into the principal's office and she's like, hey, I want to talk to Alex about this whole stuff because I'm really concerned. And the principal says, hey, it's not appropriate. You know, you've been in trouble in the past because you're hugging students. You're giving them rides home. We don't do things like that. All right. It's not appropriate. So Justine, naturally, she goes home, or I'm sorry, she goes out to the bar. And she meets her love interest, this cop named Paul. And notice that she asks him why he's got this cut on his hand. And you find out later, he kind of dodges the question. But they clearly know each other. And he's like, hey, chill with all this pity party stuff you're doing. He's apparently married to a woman named Donna. He tells Justine that they're not really happening right now. And she's clearly, you know, trying to get it in. So, you know, she does. And the next morning, he wakes up in her bed and she's driving him back to his car. And he's kind of being a jerk, giving her the cold shoulder. And she drops him off and like, whatever. So then Justine ends up following Alex home from school, even though the principal told her to leave it alone. And she sees him go into his house. So she goes up and proceeds to ring his doorbell. Naughty, naughty. And she notices his home's windows are covered in newspapers. So now she opens up the gate and goes in the backyard, as one does. And she can peek through a little crack in the newspapers that are plastering the windows in the back. And inside is a very dark house. And bam, you get a jump scare. There's two people just sitting on the couch staring in her direction, motionless. So she freaks out. She bugs out. She calls the principal. She's like, listen how bizarre this is. What the heck's going on? And he's still tripping. Of course he is. He's like, chick, I told you, quit it. What are you doing? So, anyway, so the boarding up of the house, let's talk about that for a second. It is symbolic of the subconscious of the mind, right? Anytime they show a house in a movie, that's typically what they're trying to show is the internal workings of the mind. And it's clearly being blocked from outside view, right? So something's going on in the subconscious mind, has to do with Alex and that house, and it's being blocked from external viewers. So Justine goes back to the liquor store. I guess she drank 2/5 of vodka already. And it's Donna. Donna, she's not happy that her man had a little sleepover, so they get into a fight. Then Justine has a nightmare of her class with students, and they're all dead at their desks. And you can notice on the clock, it's 2:17 if you look for it, right? And there's some stuff on the board about parasites, and, you know, we'll kind of come back to that. And you get a nice little jump scare of these creepy kids. I believe it's Alex kind of looks up from his desk, and he's got this massive smile, like a painted Joker smile, kind of. So she's tracking Alex, and as she's tracking him, you see this address of 4098, which later on in the principal's office, you see these weights. And they're 4, 8, and 9. Again, I don't know how that sort of plays into any of these theories. Maybe you can come up with something. But to me, if you force me to come up with a guess, I'd guess it's something about the dream world merging with the real world because of the magic happening in the story. Because Kenneth Grant talks a lot about the forms of dream control and how things can spill over into the real world and vice versa, right? So she asks Alex how he's doing, but he's very quiet. He's not really having it, okay? And she stays in her car, and she's watching the house. And Dummy was drinking vodka and big gulps the whole night, apparently. So she passes out in the front seat. The front door to Alex's house opens up. And a woman walks out with these scissors raised over her hair, full psycho mode. She goes up to Justine's car door. Justine's passed out, though. So the woman crawls into the car and cuts off a lock of Justine's hair as she dips. And that's it. Now we're on to the next chapter of the movie. The next chapter is about Archer. And you're going to find that these segments of the movie, they each show us the character's point of view of the same timeline. So there's a little overlap of, you know, events. So Archer is obsessed with finding his son. He's one of the 17 that ran away. And Archer's sleeping in his bedroom. He's watching the Ring camera footage on repeat. And he's a contractor. He heads off to the project, which he's neglecting because he's obviously concerned about his son. He goes off to the police station to harass them about why they haven't arrested anybody. And he's, again, like, hey, this teacher, Justine, she's hiding something. I know she's guilty. She had a DUI in the past. Blah, 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 right? And then they show him at the PTA meeting. So, you know, now we're caught up with the same timeline of the different perspectives. And he storms out of the PTA meeting and he follows Justine, sees her go to the liquor store, and follows her to her house that night. And which makes me wonder if he didn't. Oh, you know what? I just realized, because in the movie they show him with two buckets of paint in the back of his truck. He's the one that painted witch on the side of her car. Boom. I just, like I said, you could probably watch this thing four times and catch new stuff. We're unpacking it live during the recording. So Archer's back in bed. He's having these weird dreams about Matthew, and it's, you know, 2:17 a.m., and he has this vision of an assault rifle that says 2:17 on the barrel. And we get a jump scare of this creepy woman again with a crazy smile. What is this assault rifle about? Well, I mean, it could be because the film is called Weapons, because these children get weaponized. You could argue it's a metaphor for school shootings, right? Because all these kids, they just disappear one day, like a school shooting. Either way, he gets up from his dream, grabs a neighborhood parcel map, and he starts drawing lines on it, right? And he goes to another family's house. This is the one that has the house number that we talked about earlier. So many numbers. It'll come to me later. But the house number is 1948, whew, just like the 1948 thing and so on. This is another family who's also missing a kid, and he inquires with them to see their Ring camera footage. The wife says no, but he proceeds to wait in his truck for her husband, Justin Long, to come home, and he grills him for the video, and he shows it to him, which was kind of weird. And he draws another, so now he pulls out the parcel map, he draws another line. So now he's got two lines that intercept, and he circles it. Now, this is actually very important. You got this big XO mark of the beast symbol, right? We did a full show on this back in August of 23 called the Elon Musk X Conspiracy. And it was all about the lightning path that facilitates the manifestation of the Antichrist from the abyss by fusing the symbols of X and O together. Simply put, the opposing polarities come together, go with the bombs. All right? it's a wild thing. It comes from Kenneth Grant. It's deep in the weeds of the occult, but nonetheless, we see it again. And I learned all this from, you know, Freeman Fly was talking about this in the corporate logo symbolism stuff back in the day. He was talking about the X and the O coming together. And here is yet another example. So he pulls into a gas station to harass Justine, as one does. And here comes the principal with his face all covered in blood. He's Naruto running. And he jumps on Justine and starts choking her. And Archer tries to stop him. What will happen? We don't know, because we're going to cut over to another character named Paul. Paul's the cop, and his wife is, she's nagging him, you know, these wives nagging him about how he needs to go to an AA meeting. She's out of town, you know, but he's just like, whatever. And he proceeds to see Justine, just like we, you know, talked about earlier. They kind of like are flirty, right? But we see him on patrol, and he sees a suspect running down an alley with a backpack trying to break into a building. So the suspect takes off. He's in hot pursuit. He catches up to him, pats him down, and he asks him twice. He's like, do you have any needles or anything that can poke me in the pockets? And James, the perp here, he's like, no, there's nothing. But guess what? He gets poked with a needle. and he pokes him in the left forefinger, and his finger starts bleeding. So naturally, the cop socks him in the head, knocks him out cold, but notices that the cruiser camera captured the footage of him socking this guy. So he tells the dude, he's like, look, I'm going to let you go. Just don't show your face around here anymore. And Paul goes back to the station. He tells the captain guy, and they agree they're going to try and just let this thing blow over, whatever. Justine texts him. They meet up at the bar, which we already saw, right? And he goes to her place to get some smash. And real nice of him, literally just got stuck with a strange drug addict needle, by the way. So he goes home the next day, and Donna's home. Uh-oh, right? So now he's pissed off. And he's back at work the next day, and he sees the backpack guy, because apparently he got busted. That's why Donna was attacking Justine, because apparently he admitted to it or whatever. He sees the same backpack guy who he just told, like, I don't want to see you again. He goes after him, turns the camera off. Boom. What's going to happen? We don't know, because we're cutting over to another story about James, the drug addict guy, the suspect. And now we see what James was doing. He was smoking crack in a tent. He was stealing from cars, selling stuff to pawn shops. And he was going down that alley to break into the building. We see the chase again. But after he got released, he sees Alex's house after leaving the station. He tries to break into it. So he climbs a trellis, breaks through the window, and now he's lurking around the house stealing stuff. And he jumps because he sees a man and a woman on the couch, frozen stiff, just like Justine saw earlier, right? But before he leaves, he proceeds to load up on all their silverware, and he peeks into the basement, and he sees a bunch of children just standing there, motionless. And he freaks out. And he goes to run away, but the man and the woman come after him, but whatever. He gets away. He pawns the silverware at a pawn shop. He originally tried to pawn an iPad or whatever, and the guy didn't want it, but they do want to buy the silverware. And he looks up and he sees a reward poster for $50,000 for information on these missing kids. So he's like, great. So he calls the police because he wants the reward money. And he's walking around, and now Paul sees him and takes off after him. So now we resume the story. And he goes out to his tent, his crack smoking tent, and he sees a woman with red hair in the woods. And he's in the tent and he's freaking out now. He's like, oh man, who's this crazy woman? And he grabs three needles. Well, someone's about to bust through the tent. And before they can get in, he stabs at him with the three needles. And it's Paul, the police officer, who already got stabbed with a needle. And now he's getting stabbed in the face with the three needles. All right. Which is going to come up later with the parents when there's a scene with a fork. But anyway, Paul stops short of basically killing this guy. After he says, look, I know where those kids are. And so now Paul's like, all right, James, you're going to take me to these kids. And he's like, do you got AIDS or hepatitis? And James says he doesn't think so. Oh, dear. So James takes him over to Alex Lily's house, the one that's all boarded up with the newspaper, right? James is in the backseat of the cruiser, locked in there. And Paul goes to the front door, and someone lets him inside. Someone answers the door. And hours pass, and James is stuck in the back of that cruiser, all right? And he's like, where is Paul? Finally, Officer Paul comes out, and he's angry as hell, and he grabs James, drags him into the house, all right? Now, isn't this all very curious to see all the children who've been in a magical trance and end up in the underground basement? Because you already know the rituals and the rebirth happens underground. Okay. Then we cut to another chapter. Now we're at Marcus, Principal Marcus. He's grocery shopping and with his husband, and then he's in his office, and we see Aunt Gladys. This is Alex's aunt. Okay. She comes in. She's this creepy redheaded woman that James saw in the woods. And she's real creepy looking. She looks like Nick Cage in Long Legs. If you've seen that, I also did analysis about that, which was also a bonus show, I believe. And she says, like, look, I'm staying with Alex and his parents because the parents are sick. Principal Marcus is like, look, I need to talk to the parents in person. And that's kind of where it ends. And then Marcus is at home with his husband. They're watching a documentary about ants that have this parasitic fungus. All right. Take a listen to what they talk about with this fungus right now.
It is now that all free will has been lost. The ant moves under the direction of a mind separate from its own. Here, the ant initiates its death grip.
There we go.
As the parasitic cordyceps continue to feed off its body.
That's disgusting.
Fungal fruiting occurs next. Large blooms that serve to spread more spores. Or that will find more ants.
Ew.
Thank God you're home.
Who is it?
I'm so sorry to disturb you on a Saturday. Oh, will you please, please forgive me?
We're just sitting down.
The bus didn't pick me up where it was scheduled to, and I had realized far too late that I was standing on the wrong corner, and by the time I put that together, oh, I'd missed it entirely. So I had to walk all the way across town to get here.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear that.
I am sorry to tell you this, sweetie, but I am on the verge of collapse. Oh, could I please have some water?
I'm afraid that's
what... Of course, you can have some water.
Oh, thank you so much. My name is Gladys. It's so nice to meet you.
So the documentary is talking about these ants that have a parasitic fungus that makes them lose their free will. All right. There's another reference to the will. And this is referring to a strain of cordyceps mushroom, not the one found in the great coffee, the mushroom-infused coffee. It does have cordyceps, but that's a different strain, obviously. But it's a strain of cordyceps mushroom that is a parasite that they call the zombie ant fungus, and it takes over the mind of the ant. It's insane. It's a wild, it's a wild thing in nature if you haven't seen it. But it literally turns them into sort of mind-controlled zombies. And then it like comes out of their skull and then spores out more mushrooms to kill the other ants. It's crazy. And I think if ants know that one of the ants is infected, they'll kick him out of the whatever tribe. So Principal Marcus and his husband, they line up 7 glizzies to eat while they watch this crazy documentary. And I looked this up. This is a reference to a joke, apparently, from the director, Zach Cregger, did a show called The Whitest Kid You Know. I've never seen it. And there's apparently a joke on there about 7 hot dogs. So the doorbell rings. It's Gladys. And the two men are wearing Mickey Mouse shirts, by the way. And why? My best guess is this is talking about MK Ultra stuff. You know, Kathy O'Brien's Transformation of America book talks about being taken to Disney for mind control stuff and engaging in prostitution and so on. So Gladys asks for a bowl of water and tells Principal Marcus that, look, Alex's father is willing to come in, right? And she's like, but I want to make sure you didn't talk to any of the police about any of this. And they're like, what? And she's like, okay, yeah, give me that bowl of water, right? And the water is very important in this scene because she basically takes this twig from this tree that she brought with her, wraps it in the ribbon that was in Principal Marcus's office, puts some blood on it from her left forefinger, and this puts them under her spell. But the water is symbolic of the feminine, right? And we'll see this on the bell that she actually whips out to engage the ritual. You'll see the 6 and the inverted triangle, which represents the feminine or the water, okay? So she, and then at this scene, she cuts the husband's hair as well, all right? So now she can control, you know, both of them. And she rings this bell with the 6 and the triangle on it. It forces Marcus to basically drop the phone. He's getting ready to call the authorities. And you see that they are standing on a checkered floor, right? Again, opposing polarities, goat with the bobs. Marcus starts seizing up. And Gladys wraps his husband's hair around the twig, and then she snaps it. And when she does that, Marcus starts choking the husband, his own husband. And he pukes up a ton of black goo into his husband's face and proceeds to kill him with his bare hands. All right. Now, this is very much MK Ultra mind control magic. This is the purpose of MK Ultra was to create assassins to murder whoever they wanted to. That's basically what she's doing. It's a brutal, gory scene. He basically headbutts the dude until his face caves in. And then Gladys drops the twig into the bowl of water with some new hair, which is Justine's blonde hair. So now we know why he goes after her in the previous scene where he Naruto runs and attacks her. And then they show us that scene again, Marcus going after Justine and Archer trying to fight him off while they get into the gas station. you know, please, dear Lord, don't let me die at a gas station. What a horrific way to go. Now, when she's in the gas station, you'll also notice that the lottery in the town is $666 million, obviously referring to the number of the Antichrist. And this is part of my claim that this movie is more than just spooky magic. This is about the end times and Satanism, all right? So Justine, she takes off. Archer follows, but Marcus is sprinting full speed. But unfortunately for him, he runs through an intersection and bam, a car plows through him. And they show us every gory detail. Again, his head exploded on the street. And now Archer sort of changed his tune with Justine. Now they're kind of friendly. All right. Now he's showing her his theory about how everyone is running towards the same location where this X is. Justine looks at the map. She says, oh, I know where that X is. That's Alex's house. Now we finally get the story of Alex. All right. And it starts out before the disappearance event. You see Alex getting picked on at school, and his dad picks him up, and he's like, look, Aunt Gladys is sick and she's coming to stay with us. Gladys shows up with this tree. This is where she gets her twigs from. And a lot of people are like, hey, what kind of tree are we looking at here? And if you Google it, it'll say it's undefined. They say it could be some type of black thorn or a corrupted holly tree. And I looked up, I try to find some info on this. I looked up, I've got a book called A History of Magic and Witchcraft and the Occult. And the book says that blackthorn is thought of as a plant of ill omen. Yet magically, it is used to protect against evil, dispel negativity and toxins, and help people confront their inner demons. So I don't know if that fits exactly. The other idea is that magic wands are actually made from the wood of a holly tree or a holly shrub, and those are believed to have magical properties, okay? Nonetheless, it's a magical tree, and that's where she's getting these twigs from to put the magical spell on these people. Then we get a shot of Alex brushing his teeth in the mirror. Now, you'll notice that this shot is just like the one we see in The Shining when Danny is brushing his teeth in the mirror, which is, again, another story about MKUltra mind-controlled kids, right? He's got the dissociative identity alter, the other alter ego, and all that, right? Well, next we see Alex. He's in school, and he's doing an exercise with the class on this piece of paper. And the piece of paper says, what time is it? And it shows a bunch of clocks, right? Well, if you look closely, one of the clocks says 2:17. And he doesn't actually fill that one in as an answer. Then we see that Archer's crappy little kid, Matthew, who's also missing, he was also bullying Alex. He's one of the bullies. So that's interesting. So Alex walks home after school, and he goes inside to find his parents sitting frozen at the dining room table. Something's wrong. Aunt Gladys, she's feeling spry though, okay? Alex throws water on his dad's face, but he doesn't even budge. And Gladys is like, you know, go to bed, kid. Next morning, mom and dad are still at the table. And Gladys, she's got the bowl of water, and she's got a twig. And she cuts herself and wraps her blood around it and then makes Alex watch as she controls the minds and behaviors of his own mother and father. They proceed to stab themselves in their own faces with their forks over and over. She threatens basically that she's going to kill them if he acts up. Now, this is one of the original ideas behind MKUltra, which you can read about in David McGowan's Program to Kill book. He talks about this in the very first chapter. One of the things they find is that the dissociative identity disorder and traumatizing of children is one of the best candidates for mind control, particularly if they lose their parents at a young age or they, worse yet, witness it. Dark stuff, all right? Now I'm going to play the clip where Gladys is warning Alex, like, look, if you tell anyone about me being here, I'm going to kill your mom and dad. Take a listen.
Don't worry about your parents. They're just resting. Now, before you go to school today, I want you to promise that you will not tell a living soul that I am here or that your parents are resting like they are. Do you hear me, Alex? Watch. Ooh. Are you watching?
Now, again, this is a scene of MK Ultra type programming. Children forced to watch violence, particularly from people they love. I heard that sometimes they make them kill their own pets or watch their pets get killed. I mean, this is really dark territory, right? And I'm working on a big mega MK Ultra deep dive where we'll cover all the ins and outs of it soon. All right. Also notice that Gladys cuts her left forefinger. Same with the cop, stuck his left forefinger. This symbolizes the left-hand path. This is antinomianism and this is a pursuit of becoming a god, which is exactly what's happening in this movie. So Alex goes home. Gladys is meditating by this tree and she tells Alex, look, you got to feed your parents this soup. And it's a recurring theme throughout the movie. At the end here is this Campbell's soup everyone's eating. Well, there's got to be a meaning there, right? Of course there is. Well, Campbell is a Scottish name, and it means crooked mouth. One of the things you see in this movie is these scary jump scenes where people have this crazy crooked, crazy maniacal smile. I don't know if it's crooked, but it's a crazy smile. And another idea is that Campbell's soup becomes a pop culture crossover when Andy Warhol painted the Campbell soup thing, right? And it was all about taking corporate logos and making it art. And he did this in 1962, and it's called the Campbell soup cans. And what it is 32 paintings that he did. 32, of course, the second highest number in Freemasonry. It's the highest you can get without being one of the crew, right? If you want to get to 33, you got to be invited. You can't recite any whatever it is they recite at their initiations. 32 is as high as it goes if you're not worthy. And Andy Warhol, he was actually really interesting. One of the most famous artists in the world. He's from Pittsburgh, PA, so maybe near Maybrook, PA, I don't know. And, he influenced David Bowie, who had a song about him on his Hunky Dory album. He influenced Devo, which is one of my favorite bands since I watched their awesome Netflix documentary, which I recommend. Warhol also did a film called Vinyl, which was an adaptation of A Clockwork Orange. This was a few years before Kubrick did it. But he was really into pop culture, including Coca-Cola, which he did several art pieces on. And, you see Coca-Cola used in the film multiple times. All right. And this is what he said this once. He said, what's great about this country is that America started the tradition where the richest consumers buy essentially the same things as the poorest. You could be watching TV and see Coca-Cola, and you know that the president drinks Coca-Cola, Liz Taylor drinks Coca-Cola, and just think, you can drink Coca-Cola too. A Coke is a Coke, and no amount of money can get you a better Coke than the one the bum in the corner is drinking. All the Cokes are the same, and all the Cokes are good. Which I agree, I love Coke. Coke Zero, though, right? I'm not trying to get the diabetes flaring up here. So Joseph Campbell is the name of the guy who founded Campbell's Soup in 1869. Now, to the astute listener, you already know that he shares the name of a famous mythologist named Joseph Campbell, who wrote all about the archetypal hero's journey, which is used in a lot of films and film analysis, right? Which I suspect is what this is actually referencing. It's a mixture of the pop culture stuff with Andy Warhol, but it's also a clue to look up Joseph Campbell theories, which is where, you can get into this idea of the inner chambers of the subconscious being part of the basement of this house where the kids are mind controlled into. And if you guys guess who the hero is in this story, it's Alex. There's maybe some question to that when we get to the conclusion here. He kind of restores the house to normalcy after the call to adventure to participate in this weird magic. All right. So Gladys she's getting sicker and sicker, and she asks Alex to help her, right? Because she thought putting mom and dad under her spell would fix her somehow. That didn't work. She, you know, had all these other people do blood sacrifices for her to harness their energy, you know, very much like, almost like adrenochrome type stuff, right? Is harnessing the youth, the youngful energy, the young youthful energy, kind of like shunamatism we talked about with Eyes Wide Shut, something in that realm. So she's like, look, I need you to get me objects from all them kids you go to school with, the other 17 students in your class, and bring them home. So he starts snagging all their stuff. Gladys starts prepping up her little weird magic bowl, and she spits in the bowl, lights it on fire, and at 2:17, she rings her little bell, and that's the mystery solved. That's why all those kids were running out of their house at 2:17, all right? Now, that bell has a 6 and that little inverted triangle on it, and this is something we need to unpack. The ringing of the bell is a spiritual thing. That's why churches have bell towers. You see this in like Buddhism when you awake from meditation, they'll ring the bell. But more importantly, the hidden occult meaning of a bell is about the opposing forces of male and female. You've got the dome of the bell, the receiver, the womb, and inside of it is the male yoni, what they call the clapper, right? That's the male phallus. The bell is a symbol of duality. When the two come together, you have the opposing forces coming together. Right now, if you look this up, Yahoo is a terrible little article on this, and they think that the triangle on the bell represents the triple goddess of witchcraft, you know, mother, maiden, crone, which isn't a terrible theory, right? Because this will be revealed to be about this woman trying to maintain youth through magic, kind of like Hocus Pocus and things like this, right? The inverted triangle does, in fact, symbolize the feminine energy. Right? It's the womb, it's the chalice, it's the water and alchemy, and water symbolizes the subconscious, just like the symbolism of the boarded up house where Gladys is staying. It's the subconscious, it's the water. And when in alchemy, water is absorbed into the below and the masculine fire is absorbed into the above. And that could be why, you know, the sky, the male is represented by the sun god and so on. So the triangle represents the three primordial forces of alchemy, sulfur, mercury, and salt, which will come up soon, all right? Now, the number 6 on that bell, you know, the simple explanation could be, oh, it's satanic, right? And we know from my book, The Dark Path, that Saturn is the 6th planet from the sun. That's why it represents the adversarial force. So she's using the Saturnian forces in her magic. She's using black magic. She could be a member of the Brotherhood of Saturn, which uses human sacrifice. Again, we're going to do a deep dive on Saturn here in the next couple of months. So she's clearly using the Saturn energies and the feminine inverted triangle with the opposing polarities of the bell. All right. So Gladys brings Alex's dad to the police station. Again, we're watching the timeline, the whole timeline again, right? She's like, oh, he had a stroke. And she tells Alex that, look, the police are coming to the house to investigate. You know, you got to clean it up. So they clean up, they hide all the kids. And as they show, you know, time passing, Alex is feeding his parents and all these kids this Campbell soup. And one day Alex comes home and he sees Paul, the cop, frozen in the living room. And Gladys tells him, look, we're leaving tomorrow, and, you know, go to the bedroom, and whatever you do, don't step over this line of salt, which she's kind of staying in her own bedroom. It's a line of salt on the floor. Now, in witchcraft and magic, the salt is a barrier that they use to keep energies from crossing over. They use it to keep evil spirits away by making this barrier of salt. Again, it goes to alchemy. And in magic, they create a circle and a triangle to keep the entity that they conjure in the triangle of manifestation separate from the practitioner in the magic circle. Again, off topic, but in Eyes Wide Shut at the end, you see the game, The Magic Circle, which again, also about abducting children, crazy stuff, right? So now we see Archer and Justine watching the house, and they see Paul come out of the house. And Paul waves to them to come in. So they go up to the house. They walk inside. Justine crosses a line of salt, and Paul starts attacking her, as does James, the drug user, who's also in there. And Alex steps over the line of salt upstairs, like Gladys told him not to. And now his parents are coming after him. They're trying to kill him. So everyone's trying to kill everybody, right? Paul's trying to kill Justine. James is trying to kill Archer. And none of these people are going to die. They're unstoppable zombies. Archer sees, during the interaction, he sees all the kids in the basement. He's like, oh, damn, there's probably where Matthew is. Justine saves the day. She shoots Paul in the head and then in the neck and, you know, drops him. And then she also pops James in the head, who's beating up Archer. So now he's gone. Meanwhile, Alex is upstairs. He's hiding from his parents in the bathroom. And we get yet another reference to The Shining because his mom busts through the door and jams her head through the door, like the Here's Johnny scene. And Archer, he heads in the basement to look for Matthew. Meanwhile, Alex grabs a twig with the thorns and heads to the bathroom. Because remember, he learned how to do magic from Gladys. So he goes into the bathroom, cuts himself, rubs the blood onto the twig. Meanwhile, Gladys is also doing magic. She snags Archer's necklace, and now she's controlling him. So she wraps the twig, or she controls Archer, so he can't continue to look for the kids. Alex is wrapping his twig with Gladys's hair, and he basically flips the script, and now all the kids are chasing after Gladys. And they chase her through the neighborhood, and Archer's trying to kill Justine now because he's under control, right? All these 17 kids, they're running through the neighborhood. Gladys is sprinting for her life. And they finally catch up to her ass, and they start tearing her into pieces and in someone's front yard. It's very gory. And none of this stops the parents or Archer from, you know, the parents are trying to kill Alex, Archer's trying to kill Justine, but it's when the kids rip Gladys's face off into pieces and they finally kill her. That's what breaks the spell. So now Archer and the parents, everyone chills out. Justine goes upstairs to check on Alex and he's hugging his parents. Archer goes to find Matthew in that front yard where they stand around Gladys's corpse. All is well, right? Well, not so much. We find out that everyone's basically catatonic. Alex's parents are stuffed in a mental institution. And that's it. The credits roll. And a lot of people complain about this ending, which I get that. I didn't love the ending of Barbarian either, but they're both great movies, very suspenseful. But the credits roll. You see some special thanks to David Fincher, Bill Hader. I thought that was interesting. But what's kind of interesting is that all the kids, even though they broke out of the spell, they're still messed up. Okay. What if Alex is actually the guy who was kind of facilitating all this, right? Maybe Gladys showed him how to do magic and he was like, well, all these kids are bullying me. Let's mess with them. So maybe he's going to be the next bad guy in the sequel, right? So let's wrap it all up. There's a couple meanings for this. Meaning number one, this is the boring explanation for basic people. The director claims that the movie is kind of a modern day fairy tale and it was basically based upon his actual childhood dealing with addiction and stuff. He says, the last chapter of the movie is straight up autobiographical. That was my childhood. You live with an alcoholic parent and there's this inversion of the dynamic. The child can become the caregiver. This foreign substance comes in and it changes everyone's behavior. The house becomes a scary place. You can go to school and act like everything's cool, and then you come home and you hide from a zombie parent. That felt so real to me. So that's one explanation, which explains why there's all this stuff with the liquor in the movie. But that's not what you're here for. You're here for the fun explanation. The magic. The end of the world. That's what this movie's about. It's clearly to me about magic, real magic, and the attempt to destroy the world. And let me explain why I say that. Because Kreger told Gladys, or Amy, the woman who plays Gladys, he said, you have to choose between two roles. He said, this was in a Vanity Fair interview. He says, I presented Amy with two options of her origin story. I was like, you can pick one of these two. They're very different options. You don't have to tell me, but it's either this or that. I don't know which one she picked. One is that she was once a regular person, but her spells and corrosive actions are a last-ditch effort to heal herself of a life-threatening illness. The other option was that maybe she's not a person at all. The off-kilter red wigs and outlandish makeup suggests Gladys is some other kind of creature, trying to simulate what she thinks is what a normal human being looks like. So she could have chosen either one, and we don't know which one she chose. If she chose the latter, I think she did. I think she's the Whore of Babylon. Right? Now, to support this idea, there's a couple elements I need to readdress. The 1948 stuff, right? We talked about the establishment of the country of Israel, which could be referenced because a lot of the actors, including the director's wife, are Jewish. All right? Now, one of the ideas from this is that the occult system of Kabbalah is the mystical aspect of Judaism. And this is the belief that this is where all magic comes from. Furthermore, there's a belief that the end times are directly related to the third building of the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem. It's the final rebuild. And this is where the end times will take place. That's why you see all these evangelical weirdos trying to rebuild the temple and all this stuff. And Solomon, of course, one of the OGs of magic. He controlled spirits to build the first Temple of Solomon with his ring. So again, it is magic. It is Kabbalah, and it is the apocalypse. It's the end times. And they tore Gladys' body into pieces at the end, right? And first, we have to know that she has that feminine symbol of the inverted triangle, which represents the water force, which attracts itself towards the earth. So when her blood soaks into the earth, it follows its natural path of alchemy. Second, I think this is also a reference to the Osiris mysteries, right? We talked about the Osiris and the tied to the number 17. Well, Osiris was torn into multiple pieces, 14 pieces, I believe. And I can't count how many pieces her body is in to confirm that. So take that for what it's worth. But it's through magic that Osiris resurrects, right? Osiris killed on March 17th, the 77th day of the year, which numerically goes into Crowley's Whore of Babylon, which is what Gladys was. She had the fire red hair. And the whole point of the Whore of Babylon is to usher in the end times. That's why Jack Parsons was trying to bring about the Whore of Babylon. That's why the sigil for the Whore of Babylon has 77 on it, which takes us into the final point of the meaning of 217. It means the apocalypse of the goat bobs. And look at Archer, his kid's name is Matthew. So if we go to Matthew 2:17, it talks about when King Herod ordered the execution of all the male children under 2 years old because he had heard about Christ. So in a way, it's about murdering kids. Another interpretation is from Genesis 2:17. From the Orthodox Study Bible, it says, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you may not eat, for in whatever day you eat from it, you shall die by death. And the knowledge of good and evil is that opposing polarity that we've been, you know, I've been talking about this for years with the Freemasonic checkered floor that you see no less than, what, three times in this movie? And it's about embracing the Prometheus forbidden knowledge and the Gnostic view of reality. Recall, we said there was a lot of numerology and symbolism in this film, right? The 17th letter is Q. And in the QAnon symbolism, we talked about Osiris connecting with the 17, with the March 17th and the 77th day of the year, 77 being Crowley's favorite number because of Libra 77. It's on the Star of Babylon sigil and all that stuff, right? Well, that 77 is on the Star of Babylon because it's an amplification of the number 7, which is the feminine goddess. It's the liberated feminine energy of the goddess of Babylon, a.k.a. the Scarlet Woman. And that's what Gladys has, is the bright red hair. She is the Whore of Babylon, referenced in the book of Revelation, to bring about the apocalypse and the end times. which Tracy Twyman described as the moment when the two opposing polarities come together, the black and the white cube. And that map that Archer uses shows that combination of the opposing forces coming together for the mark of the beast, the X and the O, which facilitates the end times, right? And a more in-depth explanation is that the lightning bolt symbolized by the path of the Kabbalah, Tree of Life, is used to fuse the X and the O, which connects the goddess of the skies to the god of the underworld, Typhon or Nodens. And these are the opposing polarities coming together. And we already know there's a satanic vibe from the $666 million lottery. All right. And we saw the opposing polarity multiple times in the movie. We had goat mascots. We had the logo of the O and the X, or the O and the triangle, excuse me, triangle manifestation. In the magic circle, we had the checkered floors. We had the bell, which is the male and the female opposing polarities coming together. And a bonus image is if you look when Archer wakes up in Matthew's bedroom on the wall, you can see a plus and a minus symbol sketched out for no reason. It's the opposing polarities. So there you go. Illuminate, confirm, go with the Bobs, right? And I think the big question for me is, are the artists and the films, are they tapping into a Thanatos death drive towards the end times, or are they pushing for it, or are they just using this, you know, because it strikes at the heart of the deepest fear of us, right? Trying to drive interest in their work of art by, you know, sort of scaring us into it, because we like to be scared. We know that, right? So there you go. Kind of a long-winded film analysis, but you know what, you guys are worth it. I appreciate you guys. You guys keep this show on the track, so thank you so much for your support. I appreciate you guys, and I will the November bonus show, I have a couple ideas. I might do another poll. I don't always do the polls, the surveys, but keep your eye on the posts and VIP section, folks. I'll send you the email link to the Google Forms. Patreon people, you get a poll right on there. Apple people, I apologize, I don't have a way of getting a hold of you. Apple keeps me completely separate from you. But I'm probably going to do another poll because I've got a couple ideas up my sleeve, or I might just pull the trigger on what I think you want. Okay? All right. Thank you for your support. Thanks for listening. Till next time, stay positive.